I'm here with Kevin Hrun. And Kevin is a spoken word artist, amongst many other things, who I met at a spoken word festival in Berlin last weekend. And I saw him perform on stage a piece, and we'll hear that later on in the episode. And as soon as he stepped on stage, I was like, I have to talk to this person. Grabbed you after your piece, talked to you for 30 seconds, and invited you to be on the podcast. And now you're here. After also giving us an impromptu spoken word performance at the community space where I live yesterday night, which was so touching, so spectacular. So I just feel really lucky, really serendipitous and synchronous that that we're here today. Thank you very much for being here.
Pleasure being here on the podcast.
Beautiful. So I'll maybe just give a bit of introduction. So Kevin, you are a Korean. You have your background in Korea. Let me say your roots are from Korea, and you were adopted into a Dutch family, and this I'm sure has informed lots of your experiences and also part of what's informed your art as a spoken word artist. What's led you to poetry as a form of expression for your experiences?
So I discovered spoken words specifically. Probably 8 years ago, randomly on the internet, stumbled upon a video of a spoken word artist. I was mesmerized. There was something about the spoken element of it that carried so much intensity, so much emotion, that sometimes written can't. I was taken by it, and that has stuck with me. And I started looking for more spoken word, and stumbled upon deaf poetry, button poetry, and right about now.
Poetry, yeah.
So mostly North American communities. Probably 6 years ago, I started writing, and in the back of my mind, because I think what triggered me to start writing was my discovery of spoken word. I knew, of course, about written poetry. So in the back of my mind, I think I always had this idea, I'm writing poetry as a way to express myself, but eventually this is for the stage.
Mm-hmm.
It's supposed to be not just, it isn't supposed to be read per se, it's supposed to be felt and heard.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And seen.
Yes, as well. Yeah, I guess there's something about the energy in the room when you're at a poetry, a spoken word event.
Mm-hmm.
The energy of in the room together with all the other people, that sometimes even an audio recording does not have. It still carries intensity and emotions, but sometimes the whole setting mm-hmm. adds that additional dimension.
Mm-hmm. With the audience and yeah. the way that they yeah. respond to you. Yeah, and just the thrill of being on stage in the spotlight.
Yeah.
Do you remember your first performance?
Yep, I do. That was horrible. So I was so nervous. I was so nervous. It wasn't even an open mic. I was put on the lineup, a curated event. And I was so nervous that when it was my turn and the hosts signaled to me that it was my turn, I actually couldn't speak. I physically couldn't speak because of my nerves. So I kind of just gestured to the host that he had to put somebody else on. And you know, thank goodness he did. And then afterwards, there was a break. And I basically rushed to the toilet, of all places, to kind of catch my breath mm-hmm. and kind of get myself together. And then after the break, I performed. And it was nervous. It was messy. I forgot the lines. I tried to memorize, poems for when I perform. But I forgot the lines, and yeah, that was my first performance.
So you did get up on stage and do
yeah.
it afterwards. Good for yeah. you. Good for you. Yeah. I can't imagine just, you know, the first instance of, because it's so personal. You expose so much of yourself. All the parts of yourself. It's really hard to hide anything when you're on stage like that, and you can't rehearse for that moment. And to have all these people looking at you, and you're like, how are they going to respond to it? Yeah, terrifying. I remember my first performance. It was at another spoken word festival in Montreal. And I think it was just within the group of workshop participants that I was in, you know, like 10 people and no other audience, just a small room. And it was so terrifying. Like, what if they judge me? What if the things that I'm saying are inappropriate? What if I'm outlandish and the emotions are too intense and people think, oh, you know, who is she to be saying these things? And I find that poetry is, it conveys so much with so little. And it can really cut to the heart of things. And so there's this essentialism about it.
I think there's also, yes. And then, for example, the things that I write about are, all society critical. So the topics that I choose to write about, racism, white supremacy, rape culture, domestic violence, depression, suicide, all the stuff that society loves to talk about. And I think there's something about art that, not always, but, I've noticed that, in my friends group, if I want to talk about white supremacy and a lot of my friends are white, there's an immediate like, what do you mean? Do you want to talk about white supremacy? What are you saying really? There's an immediate defensiveness.
Yeah.
And art has the possibility sometimes to, address white supremacy, for example, in a room full of white people and trigger less defensiveness. Mm-hmm. And as if I have an immediate conversation with a friend about racism and white supremacy, they almost oftentimes feel immediately attacked, personally addressed.
Yeah.
Whereas a poem seems to trigger that less in the audience because maybe there's some distance still between the performance, the poem, and the audience and the performer. That allows people, whether it's men listening to a poem about rape culture or whether it's white people listening to a poem about white supremacy, that they don't feel immediately personally addressed per se, and they allow it to process more.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's that doesn't mean that we shouldn't have direct conversations, but I believe art can add to the conversation in ways that sometimes a personal conversation can't.
Mm, yeah. And I'm wondering why that is. My immediate thought is there's something about art that you feel like the audience is universal, that it's a broadcast out there, like a public service announcement, and whoever receives it, but it's not meant to criticize you, you know, because I'm not saying, Kevin, this is written for you, you know, or I'm not having a conversation directly with you that I'm expecting you to respond to me or explain to me why things are. It's more just kind of like, this is my experience.
Yeah.
How has your trajectory since that time, since of starting spoken word, been up until now?
So there are different aspects to it. I'd say, for example, topic wise, I still write about the same topics simply because they're still relevant. And I am also myself directly affected and involved in these topics. I think that the things that have started changing a lot is the way I write about topics has changed. So, for example, in the earlier like years, and it's not even that long, it's like 5 years, I think the way I wrote about feminism, for example, was more from an outside-in perspective. But the problem with an outside-in perspective, if I as a man write about feminism from an outside-in perspective, is that I'm kind of saying like I'm not part of the problem because I'm looking at it, not from within.
I'm just commenting on it as an observer.
But I am not an observer. I am the problem. I am the problem when it comes to gender inequality. As a man, I am at the heart of the problem, the common denominator around the world of gender inequality, not advancing at the pace that we wanted, is men, not women. And so if I write about feminism, if I write about rape culture, if I write about toxic masculinity, I can't do that from an outside-in perspective. I have to do that from an inside-out perspective where I center myself in a way where I explore my own responsibility and my own relationship to these topics rather than from an outside-in. And that has fundamentally changed
once I started understanding this, that has fundamentally changed my understanding about how to write from a place of privilege. So if I want to write about refugees, I can't do that talking about them. I have to do it from an inside out. So what is my culpability? What is my responsibility? What is my complicity in the problem of the refugee crises? When I speak about racism, I can do it in whatever way I want as a person of color. Yeah, because I'm the oppressed. But in any other situation where I am the oppressor, essentially where I have privilege, I have to learn to write from an inside out perspective. And I think that is probably the most fundamental thing that has changed in the way that I approach spoken word these days. And then, of course, there are side topics that aren't, I think, are less important. That is just, with time, performance gets easier. For me, at least, it became easier. That doesn't mean that I'm not nervous. That doesn't mean that I sometimes, that doesn't mean that I never forget the lines. But generally, there's a little bit more comfort with the performance itself. And I think, as I started understanding how to write from a place of privilege in a more constructive way, in a better way, in a more responsible way, also, I think I did start expanding the topics that I wrote about. So, in the earlier days, if I would write about feminism, it was more about generally about feminism. Now I realize, okay, I have to start picking topics. I have to, for example, write about rape culture and my role in rape culture.
I want to understand more about the switch from an outside in to an inside out perspective, because I think that I intuitively know exactly what you mean, and I know that that's what needs to happen for myself in regard to other topics, but also what's so hard to do for a lot of people, because it's one really challenging to recognize your own privilege if you're not used to doing that, if you're not used to looking at yourself from the perspective of other people or the perspective of history. And so, you know, not to say that I condone it, but I understand why people are reluctant to step into that perspective and say, you know, what you said was, I am the problem. Part of me says, no, Kevin, you're not part of the problem. You didn't, we just met, but I imagine that you didn't rape anybody. You're probably very aware of not being sexist or racist because you're experiencing that yourself. And I would say that there are many people who would take that perspective and say, well, I am not the problem. I myself didn't commit these things. I might belong to the group of people in history or in culture that happened to perpetrate these actions, but I myself didn't do it. So how do you explain to someone that you are the problem when you haven't done these things yourself?
So there are a couple of different aspects. And so, for example, if I would say to, let's say, a spoken word audience, and this is, a lot of people have the assumption that the people that go to a spoken word show are the left, liberal, progressive people, which is not necessarily true, but it's just an assumption that the spoken word world has about itself. So if I go on stage and say, sexism is bad, that statement is true. But what does it change? What does that fundamentally change in the mindset of the people? Because if every person in the room is a liberal, progressive, open-minded individual, every person would agree with that statement. So it doesn't change anything. Everyone is like, will nod their heads, yes, 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 yes. Now there's a couple of problems with that. One, women have been saying that forever. So I'm basically just reiterating what women have been saying. If I'm doing that, then rather than me saying it, give space to women. Two, it doesn't change the narrative in the audience, specifically men in the audience, of what everyday sexism looks like. So if I say racism is bad, people will say yes. If I say sexism is bad, people will say yes. If I say trans hate is bad, people will say yes. But do people understand how it looks like on an everyday level? And that statement doesn't change it. So that's an outside in perspective. I'm talking about the problem,
but I'm not addressing unconscious biases. I'm not addressing the my own privilege. I'm not addressing power dynamics. I'm not addressing. I'm not changing and rewriting the narrative that people have about what it looks like. And so, if I go on stage and say, "Here's what I've learned about toxic masculinity. I've never seen my dad cry. And as a result, I grew up thinking that crying is a bad thing." Now, I am doing an inside out perspective.
Mm, you're talking about your own experience to it.
And you don't always have to talk about your own experience, but it's a good starting point for an inside out perspective. And now, by saying that I've never seen my dad cry, and as a result, I grew up believing that showing emotions, crying is a bad thing. Now I'm allowing men in the room to take a moment to reflect on their own history with their own dad. And like, hey, how often have I seen my dad cry? What does it actually mean? How often have I seen my mom cry? What's my relationship to crying myself? What do I think of when I see someone crying? What do I feel when I am crying myself? And that could start changing the narrative about one specific element of toxic masculinity, which is that men, for example, bottle up their emotions. And that's a generalization, but the generalization tends to be true.
Yeah. So there's the outside in is kind of like you paint a picture, you talk about the thing that's happening in society, almost like you were writing an essay about it, like an observational third person essay.
Yeah.
The inside out perspective is an invitation to consider what it, how it affects you.
What it means for you.
Yeah.
And therefore what it means for other people in the room.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the inside out perspective also takes the perspective of, I am part of the system, therefore I am always part of the problem in case I am the one with privilege. So doing nothing would uphold the current system. So what does doing nothing look like? And what does doing something looks like? Most people in the audience would say, I'm not a racist, I'm not a sexist, I'm not a trans hater. They don't necessarily realize that they're upholding a system that perpetuates trans hate, that perpetuates racism, that perpetuates sexism and other forms of oppression. And so if you can then change the narrative of what allyship looks like, change the narrative of what mistakes look like, change the narrative of what action looks like, change the narrative of what responsibility looks like, that gives the audience an opportunity to reflect on themselves and their own relationship to each of those different topics. And that is what fundamentally an inside-out perspective does. It acknowledges privilege. It acknowledges you are part of the system, therefore always part of the problem or part of the solution. Acknowledges that there is responsibility. It acknowledges that are always oppressed and oppressors. And it acknowledges that, silence and doing nothing always will favor the oppressors. And it also, the inside out perspective also, what it also does, it tries to change, the narrative, in ways where we don't stay with generalizations that everyone will agree to, most people, like sexism is bad, racism is bad, but it dives into what does that actually look like?
Mm-hmm.
And when you go into the details, that gives people an opportunity to say, oh, I do that too.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I'm asking these questions to people of color, never realizing that those questions are actually oppressive.
Mm-hmm.
Or I'm making these statements about women, or I've made a joke. I never understood actually that making a joke is part of rape culture. Does that make me a rapist? No. Does that make you a bad person? Not necessarily. But now you know, and if you continue, yeah, that would kind of make you a sexist. That would make you a racist.
And I can really imagine that is a challenging thing to consider for some people. You know, if it's the first time that they're encountering this and there's someone on stage saying, this is what toxic masculinity looks like, and they suddenly recognize themselves in the things that you're describing, even though you're describing them about yourself, that they could feel in that moment attacked.
Yes.
And I'm, you know, and I can, again, not condoning it, but can understand the reaction to that, you know. And that's been a question that I've been navigating a lot, is how to invite people into the conversation, knowing that they're going to feel challenged, knowing that, especially people who have an unconscious, you know, they're not aware of their privilege. Sometimes ignorance is their bliss, but, and then coming and then becoming more aware creates more of a burden for them.
Yeah.
You know, how do we get people to basically take more burden than they?
So in my work, so not my spoken word, but my day job, there's a couple of things that I've noticed myself, and that's,
Could you just quickly explain what your day job is?
Yeah. So my day job is in the field of behavioral change. So I usually refer to myself as I'm a behavioral change enthusiast. I'm fascinated by, people's behaviors and interpersonal behavior. And I get hired by organizations to come in and usually work for anywhere between 3 to 12 months or longer, with, people in the organizations to help change their behaviors, get rid of bad habits, develop new habits, and also look at the work environment and see, okay, what needs to change in the work environment if you want to make sure that these behavioral changes stick? Because we don't live in a vacuum. So our environment, as much as we may not like to acknowledge that and admit that, our environment has an immediate impact on our behavior as well.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
For the past couple of years, I've been getting increasingly more requests to do diversity, equity, inclusion related work. And for me, especially the inclusion part is all about behavioral change. Mm-hmm. You can't become more inclusive without changing your behavior. If currently the work environment is not inclusive, it's because of specific behaviors that are making it non-inclusive. So inclusion for me equates behavioral change.
I want to pause there because I want to think more about inclusion means changing your own behavior, because I guess, you know, when I was growing up and I was thinking, okay, including is just like inviting everybody to the party, right? It's like, you know, come, you know, all this, you know, as long as you're here with me, I've included you. How is that different from changing your behavior? You know, what's missing there?
Because if I don't address my unconscious biases, if I don't look at my own behavior and the impact of my behavior, I might be inviting more diversity into the room. But my behavior and my language might still be oppressive. So just inviting more diversity into the room might actually mean to invite more marginalized people into an unsafe space, into a hostile space, actually more specifically, into an oppressive space. And then very likely you'll also get a very high dropout rate.
Mm.
And so there's no point in inviting more diversity into the room when we're talking about, for example, marginalized groups of people, if the behavior of the people in the room doesn't fundamentally change.
I think you have just explained why I've had so much difficulty in the job market in Germany. You know, not across the board, but one of my experiences working for a really big company in Germany was that there was plenty of visual diversity. You know, there were Asians, there were brown people, there were black people, there were gay people. And yet I felt there was something that wasn't quite right.
Yeah.
You know, I was like, I'm here. I'm, you know, tokenized. I don't think they were hiring based on tokenism, but they definitely wanted to look like they were representing a diverse workforce. Yeah. My voice was never really heard, you know, and I looked at the people who were making all the decisions. They were all white German men or white Dutch men, to be honest. And this was the thing. It's like just to have an understanding and a vocabulary of how to describe that. And I think you really did. It's like when you know, I have a party, I only serve, you know, meat at this party and invite all my friends. And some of my friends are vegetarians. And I'm like, I'm inviting you to the party. How come you don't feel comfortable here? Yeah. You know, all of a sudden, like, oh, okay, now I understand. So what's needed to, what kind of behavioral change is needed to truly be inclusive?
So I have a client that I've been working with for many years, and they proudly say that they're taking a lot of action to stimulate binary gender equality. So we're talking about men and women,
right,
specifically.
Okay, yeah.
And they're having lots of initiatives to stimulate and promote women in leadership, for example. And there is nothing fundamentally wrong with that. Here's the problem. They have not, for the last couple of years, when they've started doing like blog posts about women in leadership, fireside chats with female leaders and role models, etc., support groups for women by women, right? All these kind of initiatives they've been doing for the past couple of years, not a single initiative, not one initiative has been targeting men and educating men about male biases, male gaze, toxic masculinity, unconscious biases, the role of men in advancing gender equality.
Oh.
So recently I had a female leader that I was coaching come to me and say, I got feedback from both my male boss and some male colleagues that I have to be more assertive so that people listen to my ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, okay, well, tell me more. Like, hold on. Like, before we get into that, tell me actually more about your work environment. And she's like, I'm the only woman.
So you have to be more like a man.
Yeah.
To be
and
successful.
So she explained to me more about a work situation and what that feedback meant. And we got to the conclusion that the problem isn't that she has to be more assertive so that she's listened to. The problem is that men aren't actually listening to her. So it's not that she has to be more assertive. Men have to get their fucking shit together in that company and realize that they're not giving women the same generosity, the same patience, the same respect, the same empathy as they give other men. And so if she gets interrupted all the time, which is one of those situations, but male colleagues don't get interrupted, then the problem isn't her assertiveness. The problem is the men in the room. Mm-hmm. And she's the only woman in a predominantly male environment, especially in her team, she's the only woman. So we got to that conclusion that the feedback is just fucking sexist.
Or it's just unaware.
Both. Well, it's both. It's still fucking sexist.
It's unaware sexist.
Yeah, but that doesn't make it less. It doesn't make the impact less.
Absolutely.
And so it may be unaware, and you can give people some grace for it being unaware, but the impact can still be traumatizing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so I don't want to take away from the impact just because it might be unaware, right? Now, this is the result of a company proudly claiming that they do everything in their power to advance women in leadership and women in the workplace. But you can already see what the problem is. They're inviting more women into leadership into a hostile, unsafe, oppressive workplace because the men have not changed their behavior, have not changed their understanding of what sexism, everyday sexism looks like, have not addressed their unconscious biases. And so you get these problems. And this is the problem with the company has been taking essentially an outside-in perspective to solving gender inequality.
There is a problem. It's called sexism. It's called gender inequality. We're going to solve it by doing it the way that we know how to do it without looking at ourselves.
Yeah.
I really understand the difference now. Thank you. And the question for me is, it remains people who occupy privilege, unless they really truly believe in changing their behavior to make it better for other people. Why would they? What would be their incentive to say, okay, I guess I'm the problem. It's so much easier to be unaware. It's so much easier to say it's someone else's problem. Why should they start to look at their own role in that?
I'd say there's two fundamental answers to it. One, there's simply a moral obligation. That's one. And let me say this about moral obligation. Every organization has a moral obligation, in my opinion, to do everything in their power to contribute to an inclusive workspace. And here's why. And regardless whether it pays off, regardless whether you can monetize it, like if a company only wants to do diversity, equity, inclusion for to improve their financial situation,
why would that improve their financial situation?
Because you get to use the talents of you basically allow every person's talents to flourish. So at the moment, if your workplace is not inclusive, you're not getting the best talent expressed. You're not getting people to be at their best. You get some people to be at the best.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but you don't enable and empower.
Two, you'll be more sensitive. Probably you're likely to be more sensitive to the needs also of the market. Artificial intelligence has already shown to be biased because it's fed by mm-hmm. people. So if your artificial intelligence is biased towards white, heterosexual, cis men, you're missing out on a huge market, essentially, because your data will only be biased towards that particular group and leave out a vast audience, essentially. Right? And so those are reasons why it could be profitable to invest in diversity and inclusion. But if you only do it because you want to improve your financial situation, then don't bother doing it, because every organization has a moral obligation to do it, whether you can monetize it or not. Even if it costs you money, you still have a moral obligation to do it, because we spend more time at work than with our loved ones. I think people, generally speaking, really underestimate the significance of this. We spend more time at work than with our loved ones.
They become your family.
Well, even if they don't become your family, if we spend more time with our loved ones, it better be time spent well on meaningful things, but also in ways where we can be our 100% unapologetic selves. And so I believe that every employer, every organization, every institute has a moral obligation to make sure that every person who shows up at your institution, at your organization, can be their unapologetic selves within, you know, with their identity. And not contribute to the oppression of other people, because that would contribute to the oppression of like 40 hours, 50 hours, 60 hours. And any oppression is bad. But the fact that we spend more time at work than with our loved ones also means that we shouldn't only feel that we can be ourselves, unapologetic selves with our loved ones. We should feel that we can be our unapologetic selves 24/7. So that is a moral obligation. The second reason why I believe, it is important that people take responsibility is because the relationships that you can form with other people, especially people from marginalized groups, will become so much richer, so much more intense, so much more connecting, so much more powerful, so much more meaningful once you start realizing that you are disconnecting from them because of your unconscious bias, because of your unaware oppressive behaviors. The moment my relationships with women can be so much more meaningful when I start realizing that my behaviors are biased, oppressive, and disconnecting. Because disconnecting mm-hmm. automatically means not connecting.
Mm-hmm. You yourself suffer from your own unaware bias.
Yeah. Because my relationships cannot be as meaningful and intense as they could be. And so your life will become more richer if you can develop better relations and maintain better relationships with people from marginalized groups.
I feel like I just got a crash course in diversity, equality, and inclusion. It's really, really interesting to hear you talk about this, because the mental block that I have had up until now, kind of like on behalf of other people, which is another thing, you know, but on behalf of people who have privilege, is like, oh, you know, it's hard for you. I get it, which is also a bit patronizing and condescending from my part, right? I'm like, I know, look, you're standing on a pedestal. Why would you want to step off the pedestal? But what I've not considered is when you do have that privilege, yeah, you're disconnected from people who don't have that privilege, and you cannot connect with the people who you might want to connect with. And it's lonely.
It is lonely. And let me just jump on that loneliness. So I said that as a man, I can develop healthier, richer relationships with women if I address my male biases and unconscious biases and oppressive behaviors towards women. But just imagine how much richer and healthier my relationship can be towards other men if we collectively as men start addressing toxic masculinity and healing. Like how many men how many men can genuinely say that they've said to another man, not romantically, but just to another male friend, I love you? When was the last time you either texted or verbally said to another man, not romantically, I love you? Right? The fact that we don't dare to say that to other men is A, homophobic, and B, is oppressive, sad, leads to loneliness. And so if I can say to another man, I love you, genuinely, my relationship to that other man can be so much healthier, so much richer. So it's not just me having healthier relationships to women. It's also me having healthier relationships to men and having healthier relationships to non-binary people. And so our lives will be healthier, richer, more intense if we start realizing that we have unconscious biases, if we start deconstructing them, if we start realizing that we have privileges, and again, start using those privileges in active and better ways.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that. I would love to turn the conversation to understanding your journey to integrate, maybe is the word, or embrace or accept being adopted into a Dutch family. And I'm also like, I notice that I'm kind of like tiptoeing around my words because I don't want to like tell your story, you know? So maybe you can tell me how you would like me to say it. Like, should I, is it better for me to say, tell me about your experience as a Korean adoptee, or tell me what it's like? How should I say that?
Well, for me, because I can only speak for myself, right?
Like, yeah,
for
right,
me,
yeah.
It's okay if people, in this case, in this setting, because we talked about this already in advance, it's okay for you to ask, like, hey, you're adopted. Tell me more about that experience.
Yeah.
So early, from a very young age, it became very clear to me and my sister that we were adopted, or at least not adopted per se, like the concept of adoption, but we were both Asian looking in a entirely white environment.
Doesn't take long to figure out.
And so early on, at an early young age, we started asking our parents, like, why do you look different? Why do we look different? Why do we look different from the other kids? Like, and obviously there was also the name calling. So you have that too. So early on, our parents have always had, the rule that, whatever questions they have, and whenever they have them, we'll talk about them. And so I think there was an early awareness that we looked different, from the norm.
Yeah. Yeah. How old were you when you were adopted?
Probably about 5.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that there's that awareness, of looking different, of being, looking different. That's it. You just physically, ethnically, racially, just look different from the norm in your in our immediate. But the missing piece, and let me just say also for whomever is listening, I grew up privileged, right? I grew up I was able to go to school. I was able to eventually go to university. So in that sense, you know, I grew up in a loving home. I grew up privileged. That is not to say that I have no clue, of course, how I would have grown up if I wasn't adopted. So I'm just saying that from that limited perspective, like, I can tell you, I grew up in a loving home with opportunities, right? And there's that. The thing that's been missing in the conversations that we had early on about looking different is that our parents, did not have the understanding, awareness, and language to talk about racism. So we've always, whenever we had conversations about, hey, why do we look different? Adoption was always the answer. But the whiteness, white privilege, racism, racial biases, that was never part of the conversation. So I grew up also realizing early on as a teenager that as an Asian man, I was essentially valued at zero in society. So as an Asian, I was already valued less, but as an Asian man, I was considered useless. Right? I did not grow up with role models. I grew up with pop culture like The A-Team, Knight Rider with David Hasselhoff. I grew up with, you know, Cartoon Network, The Powerpuff Girls, mm-hmm. Dexter's Laboratory, mm-hmm. The A-Team.
They don't have people X-Men, who look like us. Batman. Yeah.
I did not grow up with anyone who looked like me mm-hmm. in a... but very importantly, I did not grow up with anyone who looked like me who was portrayed as a multidimensional human being.
And not just a caricature.
Yeah, exactly. So as a teenager, I realized that as an Asian man, I am essentially not valued by society. So I grew up with a huge inferiority complex. And so when I was a teenager, I started having conversations with my parents that I wanted plastic surgery.
Mm.
And what did I want? I wanted bigger eyes. I wanted a bigger nose. I wanted to be taller. Essentially anything to become more white. And the thing is, within their limited understanding and zero understanding of racism and their limited understanding, my parents have been very supportive. As in, they never pushed me in any direction. They always said, let's talk about it, right? And I think with their lack of understanding of the racial element in this, that probably was the best they could do to not push me any direction, but say, let's talk about it. And if you make a conscious decision, whatever decision it is, we'll support it. But it has to be a conscious decision. So you can only make a decision if we have gone through it at great lengths, mm-hmm. right? We never talked about the reason why I felt inferior. Like, we never talked about the actual reason of feeling inferior, which is racism. Now, I'm glad that I didn't get plastic surgery, but that sense of inferiority and not feeling enough, I would say for most of my life, that has been the case. And even to this day, there are still bad days where I look in the mirror and I was like, oh, I wish I was white.
Mm.
The thing that has changed with time is that I just used to have more bad days than good days. And now I have more good days than bad days. But I still have bad days regularly. And so over time, I think what I developed is an unspoken need to talk with to have conversation with my parents about what it was growing up as an Asian man adopted in a white normative, white supremacist, racist society. And those conversations we've never had. And for me, that was a big gap that only later on in my life, like up until maybe 5 years ago, I started initiating these conversations with my parents. There was a lot of racism in our family. You know, the audience, the listeners may laugh a bit at this, but, cause it's kind of like how society works today. If it's not on Facebook, it's not real sort of thing. Like if it's not on social media, it's not real. But an uncle unfriended me on Facebook and I actually blocked a cousin of mine because they just couldn't deal with my experiences with racism. So every time I would post something on social media about racism, about white supremacy, about my experiences, my cousin would always respond to that in a very bad way. And my uncle actually even asked my parents when early on when I started posting more about my experiences, because we never talked about it in our family, right? So he actually asked my parents, is he being radicalized, right? So imagine this. A person who experiences racism every day starts talking about it.
Mm. And then someone says, you know, you're
and then another family member thinks I'm being radicalized for speaking about it.
Yeah.
And so that's my family. That's my extended family.
Yeah. It's like just the idea that this could be happening for real to someone in your family is so challenging that it's easier to believe
that
you're being radicalized than to confront the truth of society.
Yeah. And also the truth of what happened in our family.
Right.
Right.
And how reflective is that of so many other people's experiences? You know, a woman gets raped. It's easier to believe that she is lying or she imagined it than the fact that most likely really happened.
Because then we get back to the outside and inside out perspective. Because
right,
if my uncle would accept the truth of my experiences with racism, he would inevitably at some point have to take an inside out perspective.
Mm-hmm.
But to say he's radicalized is an outside in perspective.
Mm-hmm. How has it been for you to speak out your experiences and, you know, and know that maybe there is going to be that effect also on your close ones, on your family, on your friends? When I say effect on, you know, that response from, right?
So I think the turning point for me was, and everyone will have a different turning point, and some people are still not there yet, like, right? But my turning point was that I went back to South Korea. So in 2010, in the summer of 2010, I went back to South Korea 4 weeks. And the only thing I knew is I have a flight to Seoul and I have a flight back from Seoul on these dates.
And whatever happens.
And what will happen, I have no clue.
Yeah.
And I think in many ways that those 4 weeks have made me both, and this sounds like a contradiction, but that trip has made me both peaceful and dangerous at the same time.
Okay.
And the reason why I'm saying it has made me peaceful and dangerous at the same time is for the following. So I traveled for 4 weeks in South Korea, and it hit me that for 4 weeks I've been traveling without experiencing any discrimination. Meaning specifically, for 4 weeks I traveled around a country where everywhere I went, everyone I met always treated me as if I belonged there.
Mm.
Up until that time in my life, I had never experienced 4 weeks uninterrupted living in the Netherlands, being treated as if I belonged there. Never. For 4 weeks uninterrupted living without any form of discrimination, being othered, like you don't belong here. Never had that in my entire life. And it hit me, wow, I've never experienced 4 weeks in living in the Netherlands without a person treating me as if I don't belong there.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And now I'm in South Korea, and for 4 weeks, everyone treats me as though I belong there. This is what it feels like. Wow, right? And then it also hit me, this should be the norm.
It's like once you got a taste of how it could be, then you're like, what the fuck?
Yeah. But it also hit, there's something else hit me. So one, it hit me like, this is the first time I'm experiencing this. This is how it feels like. I've never experienced this in my entire life in the Netherlands, which is ridiculous. That's one. Two, this should be the norm for everyone, regardless of, you know, race, gender, sexual orientation, etc. It should be norm for everyone. But three, another thing hit me, and that was, I'll never get to live the day in the Netherlands where I get to live for 4 weeks uninterrupted without any discrimination. And the reason why that hit me was, people in the Netherlands will never, ever, ever be able to see past my skin. Like, I am not that naive to believe that we will ever live in a racism-free world or a sexism-free world. I just don't believe in that. I believe that we can do better. I genuinely believe that we can do better than we do today, but I don't believe that we'll ever be free from any of that because we're subjective beings. So, meaning that we will always have unconscious biases, we will always have bad days, we will always be socialized. And can we be socialized better? And can we work hard to make the impact of our bad days be less? And can we work hard to be impacted less by the unconscious biases? Sure. But to be free from it,
I think that would be utopian. I just don't believe in utopia. So I got to that realization. Then it hit me and it was like, okay, so on the one hand, people in the Netherlands will never treat me uninterruptedly without any racial biases, with any anti-Asian biases. Okay, so one, there's that, and there's that realization. There's a certain level of acceptance. I have a certain level of acceptance that I will always experience racism, right? So that's the peaceful part. Also, the peaceful part about it was I started making peace with my Asian identity. Like, the trip to South Korea was pivotal in making peace with my Asian identity. So that's the peaceful part. The dangerous part was it should still be the norm. So I became way more outspoken ever since that trip to South Korea. I became way more aggressive about the injustices. I started looking for different ways to give voice to those injustices and to my experiences. And that made me dangerous because while I understand there's unconscious biases, while I accept the fact that people, including myself, we will always be socialized and always have biases and always will have bad days, that does not mean that we shouldn't work fucking hard to make the world better. Right, so peace and aggression at the same time. I am incredibly aggressive and dangerous when it comes to injustices because I do not accept the status quo at the moment. And that makes me aggressive and that makes me dangerous for those that want to keep up with the status quo. And I don't mean rapists. I don't mean Nazis. I mean the everyday Janes and Joes. And at the same time, I also realize I'm Asian. And I'm fucking proud of being Asian. But for most of my life, I couldn't even say that I'm proud of being Asian. And there's the peace. And by being able to say on good days, I'm proud of being Asian, proud of being East Asian, I'm proud of being South Korean and Dutch, also gives space for me to take care of myself on bad days. I am not saying I'm good at taking care of myself. It took me years to realize that I wasn't taking care of myself. And I'm still learning how to take care of myself. But I'm realizing now that part of taking care of myself is acknowledging the bad days. And I don't always have to be engaged in activism. If I need a month off and I don't do anything to improve the world, that's okay because I'm trying to improve myself. And then afterwards I can do my work better, most likely. And so as that, I am not necessarily great at it. I wouldn't even say necessarily I'm good at it. I'm learning how to become better at taking care of myself. I'm learning how to get better at dealing with the bad days. I'm learning still more things about what it means to be an East Asian, South Korean man. I'm learning what parts I still haven't made peace with. There are still very likely to be a lot of blind spots, but I'm in the process of it. And that process started in 2010 in the summer, when I visited South Korea.
There's so many questions that I want to ask you about parts of that process. How has it affected your feeling of where you feel at home is with yourself? Having experienced this peace in South Korea and then experiencing, and I find it interesting that you describe yourself as dangerous because it's dangerous only to the people who have a problem.
Yes.
With what you say. For me, I'm like, what? Go for it. You're my champion. Do more of it because it helps me and it helps other people like me and us who are doing that work. You're a hero, right? And so, you know, that feeling of danger, I also can understand, like, there's, you know, the reaction of others, right? So sometimes there might actually be a physical feeling of danger. But how does that change, like, your, just how you embody yourself, you know, to be like, the Netherlands is where I grew up. It's where my family is. It's where my friends are. It's where my home base is. Probably, I imagine you might feel more at home there than necessarily South Korea, but correct me if I'm wrong. But, you know, so in this place where I grew up, I will always experience these, you know, racist encounters, no matter how hard or anybody else works in my lifetime, most likely.
Yeah. So the Netherlands is home from a definition of that's where I currently live, mm-hmm. more specifically Amsterdam. Do I necessarily feel home there? Sometimes. I think the result of being adopted for me, one of the outcomes of being adopted, the impact of being adopted for me specifically is that I don't define home by a specific place per se. This thing that people sometimes refer to as homesick, mm. like missing a place, I've never had that.
Mm.
So for me, that's a foreign concept. I don't know what homesickness means as in like missing a place. So when a Dutch person says, I've been living in this country for a couple of years, but I really miss the Netherlands. I'm like, what does that mean? As in like interesting, fascinating. I'm fascinated by it because I don't have it. Like, what does that mean? I've lived in various countries and it never took me any time to feel comfortable somewhere. I've lived in Spain for more than a year. Immediately was there. Lived in Belgium for a year. Immediately was there. Lived in Singapore for a year. Immediately was there. And other places as well. Germany, Austria. I did not need any adaptation in terms of just being there. There were like issues with working with people that had more to do with me than with them. But in terms of like living there, I'm like, I was there and I was mm-hmm. loving it. Mm-hmm. And while I was living in Spain, while I was living in Singapore, while I was living in Austria, I never, not once missed the Netherlands. I've missed people. I've missed my parents, my sister, friends, but I've never missed a physical place. And I think that's the impact of adoption. Is that because being othered consciously and unconsciously, growing up with direct and indirect messaging that you don't belong, I think for me created this idea that I need to define belonging for myself not by a place. Because no matter where I go, I will always be othered. So I think for me, home is more, do I feel comfortable enough to be myself? And so home can be here in this podcast where I can just unapologetically say whatever the fuck I want. Home is my apartment where I can be unapologetically myself. Home can be that spoken word evening where we met, where I can be unapologetically, where I feel comfortable enough to be unapologetically myself. And I think that's what over time I've learned that home means for me. Wherever I can be unapologetically, wherever I feel comfortable enough to be myself.
And I find your response to that so poignant because we talk about third culture on the podcast and people who have moved around a lot, who have blended backgrounds, they can really identify to this. You know, it's like where, and as you said, everywhere I go, I'm othered, or everywhere I go, I'm not enough this or too much this. When I go to China, I'm not Chinese enough. I'm too Canadian. When I'm in Canada, like, you're always going to be Chinese Canadian. In Germany, I don't know how they look at me. You know, I'm definitely more Asian than I think I'm perceived. And there's a sense that, like my home for me, is in my body.
Mm-hmm.
My
mm-hmm.
home for me is in my relationships. Yeah. And my relationships might not even be here. My relationships might be in a voice message that I send to my friend in Vancouver. Yeah. And that's where my home is. It's like my home is in the interaction. Yeah. And maybe that's something, you know, similar to what you're saying, is like where I can really be myself and access all the parts of myself that I want to let out.
And for me, the addition where I feel comfortable enough to be myself is important, particularly because just because I feel comfortable being myself, that doesn't necessarily mean that my environment accepts that.
Mm.
So there's always the possibility that when I feel comfortable being myself, some people may not want that from me. But then there's the point about the being more aggressive and dangerous these days. We're like, well, if you're going to deny my humanity, you're in for a fight.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I'll walk away, but sometimes I'll be like, oh, bring it on. I have no time for bullshit anymore. You wanna question my existence and my humanity? Well, fuck you. I'm going to fight you, not physically, but verbally, and you're going to fucking lose. And so that makes me dangerous and aggressive for those that do not want to acknowledge my humanity. And so there are places where there may be racism, where I still feel comfortable enough to be myself, but the environment does not want me to be myself. But then it's like, well, this is an unlucky day for you.
Unlucky day for you, Kevin Hoon is here. Y'all are going to be more inclusive after this. You said you're proud of being Asian now.
On most days.
On most days. What does that mean to you?
Is that 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 one, I don't want to be anyone else but Asian. Like, I just want to be me. Like, and I don't feel the need to change anything about my, for example, my physique. It means that I know that I deserve humanity. I know that I deserve romance. I know that I deserve relationships and deep connections with other people. I know I deserve the money I'm paid for in my job. I know I deserve a spot on the lineup for a spoken word event.
Right.
That's what it means on good days, that I'm proud of being Asian, that I wholeheartedly embrace my identity as a South Korean man, ethnically. Because passport wise, I'm Dutch.
And you know, it sounds there for you, the Asian identity has to do with ethnicity and how your physical appearance is. Is that what Asian means to you?
It's a huge aspect of it, because
and just to say, I totally understand, right? Because you know, like I like when I say Asian, like it, like my insides are both Chinese and Canadian, and now a little bit German. Yeah. But it's what other people see. Like Asians Asians in Asia don't call each other Asian.
Yeah.
Asians in Asia say, are you from, you know, in China, are you from Guangzhou, are you from Beijing?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, in between, are you from Korea, are you from Vietnam?
Yeah.
I only learned that I was Asian when I left Asia.
Exactly. So I grew up in a white environment, right? I have no conscious memories of Korea. I do have questions, right? Like, I do have questions about how much does DNA impact you, because there are things in Dutch culture that I grew up with that I could never relate to. Never. From day one, I couldn't relate to it. And there were things that I could immediately relate to in South Korea. And it's weird, because it's like almost like the opposite of what it's like in the Netherlands. And I was like, well, interesting, because I was socialized in this environment, but I've never felt comfortable with that. Then I go to a country that I visit for the first time, and I'm like, this is it.
Mm-hmm.
And so to me, I started wondering, okay, so socialization plays a huge role in what we think, what we believe, etc. But what role does DNA play in that? What elements of what we relate to, what we, you know, is also defined by DNA. But I grew up in a white environment, and so I don't know anything really about Korean culture, Korean heritage, Korean history. And so for me, being Asian very much was about, the physical. And the reason why I'm saying that is my well-being is affected by how society sees me.
Of course.
So my ability to have, for example, healthy romantic relationships does not only depend on me dealing with my traumas and my pain and my identity and my emotions and values, but it also depends on how society sees me. If society cannot see me as a romantic interest, then I will also have a hard time developing romantic relationships.
Mm-hmm.
If society cannot imagine me to be an artist, if society cannot imagine me to be a leader in organizations, if society cannot imagine me to be the lead role, and I don't mean me specifically, but Asian men, for example, to be the lead role in a romantic comedy series movie, then it will immediately impact my ability to have real romantic relationships or even friendships with people.
Mm-hmm.
I once dated a white woman who also is a coach, and she couldn't accept the fact that I had self-esteem issues when it comes to my looks. She just couldn't accept that. She was like, "You're a coach. You're good looking. Why can't you not see that?" And I was like, "Look, I've spent my entire life believing that I was ugly, that I was unworthy of love, because I've always been socialized that I don't matter as an Asian man." And she wasn't having it. It was not possible for me to build a healthy relationship with her without her accepting that I was socialized into believing that as an Asian man, I am unworthy. But she, as a white woman, was always worthy. She was socialized into always believing that she was worthy as a white woman. And on top of that, she also had the physique that is generally considered pretty beautiful, sexy.
So this is really another outside in perspective, right?
Yeah.
How come your experience is so different from my experience? Yeah. I can't understand it.
Yeah. And so I was coming to terms with that. She wasn't. And so my ability to have a healthy relationship with her depends really on her accepting that there is a certain racial experience that I have as an Asian man that is unique to Asian men, that affects my entire belief system, that affects my self-esteem, that affects the way that I interact with the world. And yes, it's my job to come to terms with that. It's her job to acknowledge that and accept that. And if she can't accept that, then we can't have a healthy relationship.
How would you respond to people who, when they hear stories of your hardships, they say, you know, everybody's got hardships. Some people have hardships with racism. Some people have hardships with political status. Some people have hardships with abuse. You know, everyone's got hardships.
Yeah.
You know, kind of like equating that, you know, like no one's got it easy, basically.
Yeah. So let's listen to those experiences. Let's acknowledge the hardships.
Mm-hmm.
Just let's not compete. Because trauma works different for people. You can't say this is traumatic and that isn't.
Mm-hmm.
You can't say this is, there is no universal scale for pain. So if I say that racism hurts me on a scale of 1 to 10 as 10, no one has the right to say, no, it's a 6. There is no universal scale for pain. Pain is subjective. Something can cause tremendous pain for one person and not for another. So we have to learn to listen to pain, to listen to people's experiences, and even racism. So two Asian people can experience racism, but both deal with it in entirely different ways.
Mm-hmm.
And that's okay. Let's listen to those experiences. Let's learn from those experiences. And let's practice our empathy. Let's practice our capacity for empathy in those moments. And not compare it. Not put it on a
a universal scale for pain, which doesn't exist. You can't or you should or you haven't. Let's understand pain. Let's understand trauma. And let's learn to have the capacity to develop relationships with people who have gone through very different experiences than ourselves.
Mm.
And I can only do that with other people if I'm willing to explore my own biases, my own privileges, my own ignorance. Because if I, for example, would sit with somebody who's been raped, regardless of gender, though, let's be real, the majority of people who get raped are women. But if I sit down, and I have not been raped, and if I sit down with somebody who's been raped, I have to learn to hold space for that person. And my ability to hold space for that person will determine the strength of our relationship. And I think what a lot of people don't realize is that my ability to hold space for that person, to listen to their pain, to understand them, to see them as a human being who went through hardship, to not define them the way I want, but to listen to where they're at right now, and no matter where they are at right now and how they define that themselves, for me to still see their full humanity in them, my ability to do that depends on my ability to explore my relationship with discomfort, my relationship with all the things that I don't yet know, don't yet understand, which is often uncertainty, discomfort, chaos, lots of unknown, and my ability to sit with that will determine very much the quality of the relationship I can build with the other person. And I believe it's so important that we start developing that capacity to hold space and to sit with other people and sit with their humanity. And humanity means their entire experience. And if I don't want to listen to part of their experience, then I'm denying their humanity.
Have you ever felt like, God, this is too much work? You know, have you ever felt that? Because, you know, I completely agree with you, just to say, I love what you said, that the quality of your relationship depends on the ability to hold space for each other, because that will determine how intimate you can be with each other,
yeah.
How much you can trust each other, how much you see each other for who you really are and not who you want the other person to be.
Exactly.
And the fact that, you know, maybe this person has been raped, but I can't deal with that, so I'll just deal with everything else, but not this part.
Yeah.
Means that part of that person needs to be left out of our relationship. And yet I feel like there are going to be moments, and I've certainly experienced them, where I'm with someone and I'm like, wow, I cannot handle the intensity of your life experience has been. How do I reconcile that in myself? You know, I think about example. I think about, so I'm working towards rebuilding a healthy relationship with my parents. And the reason why we've been distant from each other has partially been because of the atrocities that they lived through in the Cultural Revolution in China, throughout all that turmoil, and the things that they've seen, you know, the terrors that they've seen. And I'm afraid to hold that because I don't know if I can handle that. Have you ever had experiences where you're like, wow, the intensity of this person's experience might destabilize me, might change my understanding of who I am so much that I don't know how to be anymore?
I've had experience where it's overwhelming, but I can't think right now of a moment of an experience where it was so overwhelming that it either destroyed me in that moment or destroyed the relationship in a way, like as in, I think so.
I think so. If I think about situations where I felt overwhelmed, the reason, if I'm very honest, the reason why I felt overwhelmed is because I felt that I needed to do something.
To make it better.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But at the moment I want to make it better, I am denying the other person's humanity. To make it better for the other person is not empathy, contrary to what most people believe. The other person never asked me to fix them.
Mm-hmm.
To make it better is just because I can't sit with the discomfort right now. So I want to fix it straight away.
You want to fix it for yourself.
Yeah. And yeah. I don't want to fix it for them. Like in those moments, I wanted to fix it for me because I wanted to escape the discomfort.
Yeah.
Right. So I think the biggest service we can do to ourselves, to the other person, and to the relationship with the other person, the moment when we feel overwhelmed, is to look really deep within ourselves and figure out what is so hard for me about this.
Mm.
What is this telling? What is this teaching me about myself rather than the other person? Because the discomfort isn't about the other person most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
It's about our inability to sit with it. So if I feel the need to fix it, why am I feeling the need to fix it? And if we're willing to sit with those kind of questions to explore our inner world, inside out perspective, we have an opportunity to gain incredible insight and wisdom that will help us to develop better relationships in the future. Here's an example of simple questions that we can ask ourselves as well as the other person in a situation like this. And it doesn't always have to be, you know, super high, intense, like emotional experience, but it can be simply situations that we may have not dealt with before.
Right? Mm-hmm.
So I had a coaching session a while ago, and the person, it was the first session we had, and the person said, her words, "I've got Asperger," right? Because I know that Asperger, the person, and as well as is problematic.
You mean like as a title, as a label?
Yes. Yeah. But she said, I have Asperger. That was the first time for me that somebody said that in the first session. So like, well, hey, here's my situation. And, if you're not careful in this case, in a coaching setting, you might immediately jump into rescue mode or so, like, oh my God, so bad for you. Like, how can we fix it? Or, you know, so I asked her, what would you like me to know about regarding this? It's that simple. Mm-hmm. What would you like me to know regarding you having Asperger?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Rather than thinking, oh, people with Asperger's, they are usually like this. They want this and I need to do this for them.
Yeah. And then she simply said, here's what you need to know. And she gave me a list of things that I needed to know. And that way we can have a much healthier relationship, much more bonding relationship, much more understanding relationship for me to take into consideration things. And I never pushed her because, in the sense of she brought it up.
Mm-hmm.
And then I simply asked, what would you want me to know about it? And she could answer it in whatever way she wanted.
How did she answer that?
Well, she gave me a list of things that I need to know. She's like, for example, well, actually, it's not even important, but she gave me a list of things that I needed to know.
Yeah.
And that helped our coaching conversation because I can make adjustments accordingly.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can have a deeper, stronger relationship within this coaching relationship.
Yeah.
And so it's a very simple question. If somebody opens up about something, rather than making assumptions, which is a fucking judgmental thing to do, instead of immediately trying to fix it, which is an incredibly judgmental thing to do, simply ask, what do you need? What would you want me to know about this?
Mm-hmm.
What are you comfortable with right now in sharing or not? Rather than assuming what the other person needs. They're simple questions. I know it's hard to do it in a moment because we so often want to fix things.
Mm-hmm.
What would you want me to know about this?
Mm-hmm.
What are you comfortable with right now and what not? What do you need?
There's so many more things that I would love to talk to you about. we're at the end of our time for this interview and even a little bit over time. So I apologize for that, but I just needed to ask the last question. Please tell me when you're back in Berlin. I would love to have more conversations with you. I'd love to keep learning from you. I'd love for you to keep coming by here and connecting with us here in the community.